the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
Now, dear Washington, there's a handwriting on the wall. Read it. Don't try to fight it. It'll come, whatever you do. If you try to resist it, it'll come a little bit sooner. Join it. Welcome it. And maybe one day there will be not only one euro, but one Asia as a currency. Maybe one day there will be a global currency, but it will not be dollar. That will not be the global currency. Its days are past. They have peaked.
That's Johann Galtung, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Johann Galtung on the decline and fall of the American Empire. Empires come and go. They're sometimes long, sometimes short, but ultimately they fall. Hubris, incredible arrogance, is often the element that brings the mighty down. The United States is not immune from decline. With its ruinous wars, bloated Pentagon budget, military bases all over the earth, grotesque levels of inequality, and an economy that spews red ink, we are witnessing its diminishing imperial power. Recall the words of President Eisenhower in his 1961 farewell address. He warned of the dangers posed by, quote, the military-industrial complex and its potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Our guest today is Johann Galtung of Norway. He was a leading advocate of nonviolent solutions to resolving conflicts. He was the founder and director of Transcend, a global network for conflict resolution. Among his many books are Choose Peace and Peace by Peaceful Means. He was the winner of the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. He passed away in late March 2024 at the age of 93. This special program, recorded at the University of California at Santa Barbara in 2004, is in his memory. And now, Johann Galtung.
Let me start by defining an empire. It's a transborder, concerted effort to exercise economic, political, culture dominance, popped up by military efforts. So it is, if you will, four-dimensional, economic, political, cultural, military. In the particular U.S. case, there is a planner in Pentagon who formulated it much more clearly than I can. In a very famous, very quoted statement, the purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safe for American business and for our cultural assault. Full stop. Toward that end, there will be a fair amount of killing. The purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safe for economic, for American business, and for political dominance. And in addition to that, for the cultural assault. Now, is it fair amount of killing? The 70 military interventions after 1945 have led to the killing of between 12 and 16 million. That is probably a relatively low estimate. Why is it so imprecise between 12 and 16? Well, it's the difference between overt action and covert action. Let us now say that we have that as a model of what imperialism is about. How would we know that that empire is dead? Well, if we have four dimensions, we have four criteria. And let us say that these are the things that the rest of the world would like to see. Point one, stop killing and withdraw military bases. Point two, stop exploiting. And that means stop extremely unjust, inequitable economic deals. But unfortunately, the implications are worse than that, because 125,000 people are dying every day of hunger and easily preventable and curable diseases. If you take that and you multiply it by 360 days, you start coming close to 50 million per year. Now, not all of that is laid at the doorstep of the United States of America. But the interesting thing about the United States of America is that they are the ones who keep the military machinery going that makes it difficult to change it. So when there is an effort to change it, there will very likely be a coup instigated by the U.S. and with a military follow-up. We can now go through the whole post-World War history and document this, and we can ask questions like, why is there an effort to overturn Chavez, but not his predecessor a couple of generations ago, Jimenez? Why the effort to kill Castro, but not Batista? Why is it against the Sandinistas, but not against Somoza? And the answer is very clear. And it lies in the brilliant formulation by the Pentagon planner. So we go on to number three. Join the world. You're not located on a platform named exceptionalism. Join the world, participate in the difficult enterprise of making the world a better place to live for 6.2 billion human beings. The best organization for that today is the UN, with all its shortcomings. You don't step out of the Kyoto Protocol, you invite a conference to revise it if you have grievances. And there are shortcomings in that protocol. You don't step out of the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty. You come up with a system that provides the same level of security as that one did. You don't step out of it and introducing the NMD instead. Join the world means that you see yourself as a normal country. And that leads to the cultural aspect of the empire. Give up the idea of being a chosen people by God with a direct mandate, and that you somehow have the solution to all problems. The antidote, the opposite of this, is called dialogue. In other words, to get backwards, dialogue. For the political aspect, participation. For the economic aspect, equity. And then, how about the military aspect? Instead of seeing security problems all over, and there are some security problems, shift your attention, see conflicts all over the place. And instead of building strength, try to solve them. It's possible. It can be done. But in order to do it, you have to give up one idea, namely that the other party is born evil, will continue, remain evil, and that the only remedy is to crush and exterminate. Unfortunately, these four aspects hang together, so I think what the world is demanding is, in one sense, a tall bill. In another sense, not that terribly difficult. Stop killing, withdraw your bases, have equitable economic deals, join the world, for all its multilateralism and slowliness, and enter into dialogue with a fascinating variety of civilizations. Can be done. Most countries try to do it, more or less perfectly. If this should happen, the greatest beneficiary from the decline and fall of the U.S. empire would be United States of America. It would blossom. Why? Well, first of all, it would get rid of an enormous economic burden. All of us know a little bit about costs of empire in economic terms. But secondly, it would get rid of an enormous amount of fear. And that fear is based on a mechanism which is ridiculously simple. One day all these people that we have bossed and bullied and killed will come back and do the same to us. Since there have been 240 military interventions since Thomas Jefferson started in Libya, there are lots of people who might dream of vengeance. In order to get out of that, you withdraw your tentacles and you start processes of reconciliation. Let me give an example. Germany occupied 25 countries during Nazism and tried to exterminate three nations: the Jews, the Sinti Roma, and the Slavs. They had a program for eliminating 100 million Slavs, 50 million by killing and 50 million by starvation. Mainly Russian Slavs, to empty the territory for a German colony. Well, they took 26 million Russians, 6 million Jews, and an unspecified number of Sinti Roma. If you take 25 occupied countries plus three nations, you get 28. Today, Germany has good relations to, practically speaking, all 28. What I've said so far is that an empire is a very clear construct. There's no mystery what it is about. And it is the synergy between the four dimensions that makes it. The abolition of the empire is not a question of hoisting and unhoisting a flag at midnight. That was the old way of doing it. Four very clear demands. And they're very reasonable. The greatest beneficiary will be the United States of America. And I stand on exactly the same line as Gore Vidal. I love the U.S. Republic and I hate the U.S. Empire. And please never fall into the temptation of calling somebody who criticizes the U.S. Empire anti-American. It's exactly because we foreigners make that distinction that we're in a position to be honest and say what I exactly said. There are public opinion polls among Muslims showing that more than 80% reject U.S. foreign policy and more than 80% admire United States of America. It's entirely consistent. You can say, don't you get into difficulties when you see the number of people who support Bush? Well, we get into some small difficulties. But you can have difficulties with all countries, you see, including my own, little Norway. But I am perfectly capable of loving my country without admiring Quisling. And I can love Russia without admiring Stalin. In order to make those distinctions, you actually need only two cells in your brain. But if you have only one cell in your brain, it starts getting problematic. So let us now take this construct, the U.S. empire, and then we introduce an approach to social science called dialectic. Don't confuse it with Marxism. Marxism was a very poor type of dialectic. It's a Chinese concept. Don't confuse it with Greece, with Heraclitus. It is Taoism. It's yin yang. To every force there is a counterforce. Don't confuse it with Newton. There's no guarantee it will be exactly opposite and that it will be of the same magnitude, but it will be a counterforce. Which incidentally is a reason that the worst game a political elite can play is golf. Because it's a linear agenda. You see those 18 holes? Fill them. Now in the real world, the holes move. They make alliances. They cover up. They shoot the ball back, and worse. Suddenly the 18 holes surround the player, starting digging a hole, a quagmire for the player to fall into. Well, that's what the world is like. Now, put the politician into a golf course, and you get an incompetent one as a result. That doesn't mean that he cannot do it in brilliant short time, but he's in for some surprises called dialectic. I have a list here of 14 counterforces to the U.S. empire. But I'll first make propaganda for my predictive ability. In 1980, I made a prediction with a list of 5 counterforces against the Soviet empire. That the Berlin Wall will fall within 10 years, and the Soviet empire will follow. One of the places I made that prediction was in Moscow. It was not excessively popular. But one guy came up to me afterwards and said, "What makes you think that we will last as much as 10 years? Why, what makes you think that?" So I said, "Well, you know, these 5 contradictions need their time to synergize and synchronize and work themselves through the system." And he said, 5, there are many more, but I don't care to tell you. Well, it fell. It happened. I can mention to you which the 5 were. Number 1, it's very simple. Between Soviet Union and the satellites who wanted independence. Number 2, between Russia and the other parts of the Soviet Union who wanted autonomy. Number 3, between town and countryside in the Soviet construction. Number 4, between the socialist bourgeoisie and the socialist working class. And number 5, between liquidity and lack of goods. And you can then see all these 5 working. How about freedom? Well, freedom is in the first 2. How about human rights? In the first 2, maybe the third 2. For me to talk about the contradiction, there have to be concrete social forces. Not words, but forces. I can now read for you the 14, but I'd rather take them first in groups. Economic, military, political, and cultural contradictions. You guessed that one, because those are the 4 dimensions of imperialism. And then there is something I call social contradictions, which are concrete social forces building up. And among them I have between state and capital elites and working classes of unemployed and contract workers on the one hand, and on the second hand between the older and middle generation and youth. I have this in 2 ways. In the global scene and domestically in the U.S. But let us now simply get started with economic contradictions. I have 3. Between growth and distribution, between productive and finance economy, and between production, distribution, consumption, and nature. Start with the 3rd one. Peak oil. In an economy desperately in need of oil, with very few serious attempts to move in other directions, with a peak oil phenomenon of increasing costs and increasing difficulties finding exploitable places, there will be increasing military warfare to conquer the places. Many of them are in Central Asia. Hence, contradiction number 6, which is with the biggest countries in Asia, Russia, China, and India. The oil fields border on them. They're also hungry for oil. It's 40% of humanity. So number 3 spills into number 6. I just give it as an example of the type of synergies you get when you list the contradictions. Climatic changes, global warming. The way in which the U.S. is held accountable exactly by stepping out of the Kyoto Protocol. And you will, of course, remember that people are not necessarily very subtle. When you get into the habit of blaming U.S., U.S. will be blamed for everything. Sometimes even I will come up and say, "Look, look, look, that's going a little bit too far." No, not that one. There are some others. There are some other crooks in the world. Not all the crooks live in Washington. You have to have a more diverse perspective on the world. At this point, there was a guy called ABB, anybody but Bush, He was also known as John F. Kerry, who had, I think, a very good program in this particular field. Very good and admirable program. I would guess that very many Americans agreed with him on that one. But they didn't have top priority. Other things had top priority. What? Well, I'll give you my best hunch. This is a footnote, an aside. If you believe that you are the chosen people by God, then you would also believe that God protects you. If God protects you, 9/11 would never have happened. Means God did not protect you. Because he would have stopped the planes in the air, like the kamikaze wind that came and stopped the Mongol invasion of Sun Goddess protected Japan at the end of the 13th century. Anyhow, 9/11 happened. Why? Because Americans hadn't kept their side of the covenant. What was the covenant? 10 Commandments. What do Americans do? Same-sex marriage and abortion. Californication. So given that, what is the way to regain God's protection? Now what could be more important than God's protection? And then some guy comes and starts talking about windmills. Yeah? Solar collectors. Sounds like petty stuff relative to moral and family values. But I'm then saying that I don't think those moral and family values were just norms to regulate social intercourse. I'm saying that it had a deeper existential fundamentalist rooting. And that is the country in which we are in this moment, right now. Number two was between productive and finance economy. It works the following way. That if you have a very rapid growth in the finance economy, meaning the stocks are doing fine, the dollar is surging, but at the same time you have nothing corresponding in the productive economy, but a sluggish economy with a low growth rate, then the asynchrony between finance economy and productive economy will hit back and take the form of a crash. Last time that happened was 2001, between the so-called new economy and the reality. It's the gap between the finance economy and the productive economy. I predicted it 2 years ahead of time, and I have one advantage in my life. I'm not trained as an economist. So it is so much easier to see reality when you have to see it through the type of crazy training these guys get. It becomes very difficult. I admire any economist who nevertheless could talk sense. There are not many of them, but it happens. So, having said that sweet, charming little how to make friends remark, then let me just say the following. I think the U.S. is in for a rather major crash, and I'll give you one hint. Whenever you read that Dow Jones is going up, you are closer to the crisis. Unless there is a corresponding surge in the productive economy, which there will not be. One particular financial instrument has taken the dive already, the dollar. What's this mean? That there is no confidence in the dollar, given that 60% of the dollar, the U.S. bonds, are owned by a couple of Asian economies, that China and Japan are financing the war in Iraq, that the deficit is, as you know, both the fiscal and the total deficit are enormous and increasing all the time, $2 billion per day. Given that, you have lack of confidence. This lack of confidence will then increase exponentially to a possible free fall. Now, how is the country going to overcome that? There are two possibilities. One is the official one that any economist, any bookkeeper can point out. You use the cheap dollar in order to increase your exports. What's wrong about that one? What's wrong about that one is what I call the social contradictions. It was reported by Lester Brown recently that 8 of the 10 leading U.S. product brands are American. More than half the sales of each of these brands are outside the United States. The Financial Times reports that some of the world's strongest consumer brands, like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Gap, are being hit hard. Coca-Cola sales in Germany dropped 16% from the similar period last year. McDonald's is in crisis. Disney World in Paris is bankrupt. GM and Ford in Germany are about to close, and so on and so on. Now, this is not good news if you want to strengthen your economy by more export. There's much more to come. Now, I'm not going to report all of that. I'm just going to say that this is not an organized boycott. It's much worse. It is a feeling of disgust. And this feeling of disgust makes Coca-Cola taste bad. There are medical reasons for that. An idiotizing, fattening, tepid, seeping liquid. But leaving those aside, this feeling is spreading. In order to understand that feeling better, we have to look at those data that you all know, more or less, about how did people vote when they were asked, how would you vote if you were an American and were participating in the elections today? Well, you have probably seen it, it's reported. Of all the countries outside Europe on this map, there were three countries favorable to Bush. The other ones were all favorable to ABB. And the countries favorable to Bush were Poland, the Philippines, and Nigeria. India was about equal. Now, Poland and Philippines have one thing in common with Bush. Together with America, those are the countries that get the highest score. If you add up the number of people who believe in God and the number of people who believe in Satan. If you do that for the U.S., you have to add 94 and 71, and you get, of course, 165. If you take similar processes for Poland and Philippines, you get about the same. But the U.S. is number one in believing in Satan. There's no other country in the world that believes that much in Satan. And in the Chicago Tribune's report, which was reported in the Yomiuri Shimbun in Japan the 3rd of January this year, it is pointed out very clearly that by Satan, the pollsters made it very clear it's somebody who is on full-time duty and interferes in your daily life. Now, Michael Moore's point that Americans are a frightened race, I think misses a point. It misses the theological underpinning. So what I am saying that I can explain Philippines and Poland theologically. And you should not see it as political allegiance. So, I take it as a theological statement. Nigeria, I simply don't understand. So, India can understand, was a tie, the common enemy of Muslims. That, I think, makes some kind of political sense. And has, of course, been the Bush administration's effort to circumvent the alliance formation between Russia, India, and China. An alliance formation which eventually will cost the U.S. very dearly. Well, having said this, I am saying that the sentiment is of such a kind that people are not going to buy American goods. That means the export market is limited to what governments buy because they don't dare boycott because they might be bombed. Whereas a private guy who passes Esso, Texaco, Mobil, and not to forget Shell, and just goes on to the local pump, it's very difficult to bomb him. So the way they do it with governments is to more or less coerce them to buy arms. In order to be able to sell arms, you have to produce insecurity first. At that, the U.S. can be relied upon for producing the insecurity that at least stimulates the arms trade.
You're listening to Johann Galtung, on the decline and fall of the American Empire. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1 800